Good afternoon, everyone, and this is an afternoon this time because I'm starting everything a little bit later because of cybers, things, busyness, just another one of those weeks. So this week has been a busy week as always. I went down to Melbourne on Monday to speak at API Days. I did the opening keynote for those guys on how your API is being pwned. Now, API Days was kind of cool because I spoke at the first API Days in Sydney 3 years ago in 2015. So it was neat to go back this time and speak there again. I spoke a lot about things that I'd been involved in personally. So things like the Cloud Pets, for example, things like the Nissan Leaf that I think is probably still the most significant, one of the most significant incidents just because it was due to a car. And like it wasn't driving the steering wheel or throttle or anything like that. It was turning on air conditioning units and this sort of thing, pulling back trip history, battery status. Made a lot of headlines and it was handled kind of badly as well. And then had a funny wash-up. And just in case you haven't seen it, the funny wash-up was they took the system down for about 6 weeks after I went public with it. And when they put it back online, the app had a bit of content in there which was copied and pasted from Stack Overflow. Like someone had literally copied and pasted the text, which was along the lines of the spirit of Stack Overflow's coders helping coders. And that appeared in the customer-facing app. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, do a quick Google for Nissan busted for copying code from Stack Overflow. So that was Tuesday I spoke there. Then I went up to Sydney, and on Wednesday I spoke at the Fortinet Fast and Secure conference. So that was a very, very different sort of style of conference, a lot more well-dressed people. Met some really awesome people as well, though. So thanks to the folks who came along and said g'day there. Did some media bits and pieces and a panel with them. On the plane home on Wednesday night, Thursday morning, I did the webinar for Varonis. So Varonis, I've done a bunch of stuff with in the past. I did a webinar for them on the modern state of insecurity. That webinar was recorded. Had a bunch of cool questions at the end as well. It will be available sometime soon. I'll share a link for that. But that was kind of neat doing that with those guys as well. So that was the travel and the speaking and all that sort of stuff. Now, a few other things that just sort of came across my radar that I thought were interesting and worthwhile talking about this week. So this one might go a little bit longer. One of them that just, I don't know if like touched a raw nerve is the right way of putting it, but one of the things that made me, I guess, equally frustrated and sympathetic was around authenticity online. And I'm going to tell you what I shared just here. So that the message here, or the title of the headline, is Blogger Bombarded with Abuse Over Fake Pancake Snap. And here's the way this broke down. There is an Instagram, I can't do it without air quotes, Instagram star. So a young girl who takes lots of Instagram photos. They're very nice looking settings. Of course, they always look very glamorous because, hey, it's Instagram. And this girl, Scarlett London, she's 24, took a picture which was a sponsored picture. Now, this is where the problems start to begin. So she is sitting on a bed, I assume in her pajamas, with what is meant to be a stack of pancakes next to her bed, and she's holding a teacup. Now, notice I didn't say cup of tea, teacup. And then behind her on the dresser is a bottle of Listerine, the mouthwash. Anywho, so she's Snapchatted. Which one are we on now? She snapped this photo and put it on Instagram. And the title here, or rather the message beneath the photo, is "The best of days starts with a smile and positive thoughts and pancakes and strawberries and bottomless tea. My morning routine is now live on YouTube. And while I don't show you my real bad hair, trust me, it's not pretty, I do give you a little insight into how I start my day in a positive way. Head over to my stories for a swipe up link and let me know what you think. It features my morning habit of rinsing with Listerine Advanced White," product placement, "to help," and it doesn't say product placement either, "to help whiten my teeth." Now, in fairness, actually, afterwards, I didn't see this, but it does say this is a paid partnership with Listerine. So obviously they've gone, this is an influencer, someone who's got some profile. We're going to give her some cash in order to talk about Listerine. Okay, fair enough. At least it's clear. The problem is, and I actually feel very sorry for her, and I'm going to talk about this, but I'm laughing because the problem is the pancakes aren't pancakes. The pancakes are, what was the right word for it? Tortillas or enchiladas? Or, you know, like the really, really flat, like Mexican bread. I'm terrible with my Mexican names. Tortillas, here you go. The pancakes were actually a stack of tortillas. Also, the cup is empty. Now, clearly I don't know a lot about Mexican food, but you look at it and you go, maybe they're really thin pancakes. I don't know. I could debate that. But when you look at the cup and there's no tea in it, and the whole premise is around having bottomless cups of tea, you kind of go, all right, I don't need to be like some gastronomic expert to know that that cup doesn't have any tea in it. Now, the point of all this is that this massively blew up in her face, and people absolutely lost their freaking minds to the point of death threats. Now, this is where I become very, very sympathetic to the girl, because obviously this was bad judgment. There's no doubt about that. But the way people get so vitriolic online, a cup doesn't have any tea in it. Like, who really cares? It's a cup. It just sort of went way overboard, and she's then had to sort of come out and go, look, I'm sorry, it wasn't meant to be like this, so on and so forth. Anyway, here's the whole point about this and the reason I'm talking about it. And I'm just checking. I've linked to a tweet for some reason. I'll explain why in a moment. The reason I want to talk about it is that the integrity and the authenticity thing, I think, is enormously important online. And there are many opportunities where organizations will pop up, like in that case just there, to myself and say, look, we would like to give you something with some form of expectation of return, the return being positive promotion, nice words, something like that. And I have written before about how I choose the things that I endorse. And usually what it boils down to is, am I using this thing already and do I like it already? And would I be saying this regardless of whether they gave me any money for it or not? And when they do give me any money for it, I'm going to be very, very crystal clear, which, again, in her defense, she was. So the reason I was just hesitating there is I linked to a tweet in my notes here. And there's a tweet from a guy here says, it's at Troy Hunt. Hi, we've chosen you for a free Cloudways account to show our appreciation. How about a review? How about get stuffed? No, I don't know what a Cloudways account is, but I don't care. Because the last thing in the world I'd want to do is take something from someone like that and then promote it as though it's some sort of organic natural thing that I do, like pancakes in bed in the morning, and then have someone go, well, no, you don't actually have pancakes. Well, you know what I mean. The point is that there's a huge amount of value in authenticity, and particularly in an era when so much of that is eroded and where you just don't know what to believe online anymore. I just think that this whole thing of manufacturing a persona which is not consistent with reality is enormously damaging, and I reckon it can come back and bite people that go down that path. Now, to that effect, every time I take a photo of beer, trust me, I drink the beer. There are no doubts about that. When I take photos of jet skis or beaches, I am damn well riding that jet ski hard, and I'm laying on the beach afterwards. So all of that stuff, and look, all the other things as well, are absolutely legitimate. And I think everyone I spend time with knows that. But yeah, look, it just touched a raw nerve with me. Anyway, let's go on to the InfoSec-y things. Chrome 69 hit. Now, Chrome 69 is kind of interesting for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is when you open it up, it doesn't look like Chrome. So visually, there are a lot of changes. Now, keeping in mind, this is the 10th anniversary of Chrome. It's only 10 years we've had Chrome for. Before that, we all use Internet Explorer, and that's another story we won't talk about now. Now we just use Internet Explorer to download Chrome. Anywho, so it's 10 years. They've gone and done a lot of visual changes, so things like the address bar is very, very rounded on the edges. I'm looking at it behind my tab here. I'm just trying to remember, was it material design, the word they've used for it? Everything looks a lot flatter. The tabs themselves are kind of curvy as well. Visually, I mean, I don't know. It's different. It's not making me fall in love with it. But the bits that are interesting is the security indicators. And this is now going to start us down another train of discussion. So there's several significant changes as it relates to security indicators. One is the word secure is gone from HTTPS sites. So if I go to my blog now, and I'll get the pancakes or tortillas off the screen. If I go to my blog now, going back to Chrome 68 and Chrome many, many things before that, what I would have seen is the word secure, I would have seen a padlock, I would have seen HTTPS, and a whole bunch of those things would have been green too. Now what I see is a padlock, and that's it. So the word secure is gone. The other thing that's gone is the scheme is gone. So I don't see HTTPS in the address bar anymore. I said the word secure is gone. The padlock is not green anymore. It's black. And the other thing is, and I didn't realize this when I tweeted it the other day, I totally glossed over it, is the www prefix is gone. So my blog has a canonical path which takes any naked domain, so troyhunt.com, 301s it over to www.troyhunt.com. And if I click in the address bar, it doesn't show www, but if I copy this and I paste it, then I see what's on the clipboard is HTTPS and www. So if you're copying and pasting links, that prevails. So this is really interesting between the secure text, the padlock, the scheme, and the www. All those things are now gone. And of course, the padlock is still there. The green has gone. So this is really interesting. And as is prone to happen on the internet, there was much losing of minds between a bunch of people. Now, first of all, there shouldn't be any surprises here because Google has flagged this for a very long time. I remember in May when I was at LocoMocoSec in Hawaii, I saw Emily Stark, I think it was, from Google, talk about the changes that were coming. And she gave really, really good reasons about research that had been done into usability and people's, effectively, their ability to interpret what is even in the URL and the necessity to keep simplifying things. The other thing which I think is more significant is by removing the secure text, we're starting to remove some of the positive visual indicators, the secure text, the green, and the HTTPS scheme. And this is taking us down a path where now secure is much less obvious. So the positive visual indicators are declining. The negative visual indicators, if I go to scripting.com, thank you, Dave Weiner, another story. That still looks the same. Still says not secure, although you don't see, I don't know, I'm not even sure if he has a www prefix on scripting.com. No, he doesn't. Naked domain. Dave likes naked. there's a thought for you. So at the moment, it still says not secure. One of the things that was flagged by another member of the Google Chrome team, I can't remember her name, so apologies for that, but I did retweet her the other day, but she flagged that next month, in Chrome 70, so remember Chrome has a release cycle of about every 6 months. Next month in Chrome 70, not secure is going to be red on form input. Now this is interesting because if you remember when the not secure text started being introduced in the first place, we first started seeing it when you're entering passwords or credit cards. Then we started seeing it when there was any other form input on the page and you entered text. Then we saw it for everything, which is the Chrome 68 update, which shipped, I guess, 6 and a little bit weeks ago. Now what we're seeing is the next level of that, where let's start making things red. And I suspect that they'll follow that same paradigm of releases, where it'll be look on form input, and then it'll be on everything. And in the very near future, we'll go to this website here, scripting.com, and we will see a glaring red, not secure warning. So the visual indicators are evolving, which is actually kind of interesting. And it's interesting because those negative ones are getting much more prominent and the positive ones are getting much simpler. And when I look at my website here and I see a padlock next to troyhunt.com, I don't think it'll be that long, and certainly this has been flagged before we won't see a padlock. It'll be like, why do we have to show a padlock? Of course it's secure. 90% of websites in the world are secure, or whatever percentage it is we have to get to before that actually drops off. So that was kind of interesting. The unintended side effect for me personally is I've got a number of blog posts in draft that have got a bunch of screen caps of browsers. I've got to go change them, otherwise they're going to look dated as soon as I publish them. But, you know, hey, that's not so bad. So anyway, the visual indicators are cool. Chrome 69 is here. Go and grab that. I'm sure there's other things that are new in it as well. If there's something new, leave me a comment so I know what it is. Otherwise, I've got to go and read about it, I guess. Now, another thing here, spyware. One of the blog posts I have in draft is about spyware. And specifically, it's about using spyware to monitor children. The reason this is topical today is yet again, and this is three out of three in terms of the last 3 weeks, there's been another spyware application, and I'm going to damn well call it spyware and not parental controls. It's been another spyware application that's had a data breach and spilled their data all over the place. Now, going back, it would have been 2 weeks ago, I spoke about SpyPhone, and SpyPhone had a data breach, leaked a bunch of data, that's now in Have I Been Pwned. And at the time, I was tweeting going, look, parents, just never do this, like never install spyware. And to quantify what I mean by that, and I will make this very clear in the blog post, this is software that runs in a privileged fashion on the device, and it has access to things like photos and messages and audio, and it takes those and it puts them up in the cloud of the provider who provides the service. Their cloud then gets breached and kids' data gets spilled all over the place. I am sympathetic to parents, non-technical parents, because they do not understand the consequences of what they're doing. I'm less sympathetic to some of the tech folks that were disagreeing with me on this. In fact, someone was even saying, oh, you shouldn't call it spyware. It's like, dude, the name of the product literally has spy in it. And the one I'm about to talk about also has the word spy in it. I'm going to damn well call it spyware. It's what it's intended to do. Now, very often as well, this software is used surreptitiously where you might have a crazy nut job husband who installs it on his wife's phone so he can monitor her comings and goings and discussions and everything without her knowing. So it is used for some pretty nasty purposes too. So this sort of stuff keeps getting breached. So 2 weeks ago, it was SpyPhone. Last week, it was another one. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I do remember the name of the one this week because it was on Krebs just yesterday. And it is one that has been breached before. It's mSpy. Notice the word spy. And mSpy is already in Have I Been Pwned as well. That went in a couple of years ago because they had a big data breach too. And I'm sort of like tearing my hair out writing on the Twitters going, stop installing this shit on your kid's phone because this sort of stuff will keep happening and data will get leaked. Now, and this is what the blog post will talk about. That is very different to many of the other native parental controls that are built into things like iOS and like Windows PC. I use some of the Microsoft bits and pieces for my son. So he uses his laptop, which he logs in under his account. It's all joined into the family stuff. I get to see how much screen time he's have. I get to see the websites he's going to, the search terms he's putting in, all this sort of stuff. I use it on, that we've got an old iPhone that he uses very occasionally after asking permission and then with supervision. And I use it on there as well so he can't just install random apps and things like this. Scott Helm has written before about Pi-hole, which is a Raspberry Pi, almost like DNS resolver, where if you try and resolve certain host names, it will just block it. Kills a lot of ads and shit like that, as well as keeping your kids off the nasty things. So I'm going to write about these things because there's a very, very different premise to software designed to take personal things from a device and put it on someone else's servers, as opposed to either natively within the operating system having controls to do that, or things that operate at, say, the DNS level locally in your environment. And I strongly suspect, I know for sure, that the vast majority of parents just don't get that. One of the tweets that I've also embedded in this draft blog post is there's a kid, and look, I don't have any way of verifying this, but it sounds very feasible. It's a kid who says, yeah, my parents put parental control on my device and I circumvented it straight away. Because guess what? Most kids these days, certainly once they're in teenage years, are going to be more tech-savvy than their parents. And they're going to figure out how to get around this stuff. It'll be like people in Australia, you sit down to watch something on YouTube and it says, oh, you can't watch it, you're not in America. What do you do? Do you walk away and go, oh, well, I guess I've been foiled? Or are there easy ways of circumventing basic controls? Hypothetically. So, spyware. Now, another one. This morning, Friday morning my time, for folks in the UK, Thursday afternoon, relevant to the UK because it's about British Airways. So British Airways has been cyber hacked. Somewhere in the order of 360,000, I think, accounts have been compromised. Very early days, the headlines I've seen have been along the lines of attackers in the network for 16 days, exfiltrating a bunch of data. Now, mind you, 300 and something thousand accounts for British Airways doesn't feel like a lot. And 16 days feels like a long time. So I'm not sure quite how they got that information, what the attack vector was, anything like that. But clearly, British Airways is a massive organization. They do hold a lot of sensitive information. For example, you make bookings, you provide your passport details, you provide your credit card information. And they have said that that class of data wasn't exposed, but of course it then calls into question their broader ecosystem of InfoSec. They also have planes, you know, and they have, obviously we're a little bit conscious about anything cyber related that might come anywhere near a plane. And look, these things are very, very, very different systems in very, very different parts of the organization. But be that as it may, it's the sort of organization where when there's an incident like this, it does make big news. So I'm kind of interested to see where that ends up going. Now, one other thing I want to talk about, and then I'm going to talk about the blog post this week. I tweeted earlier this week, I was in the middle of half a dozen different disclosures to organizations whose data had been sent to me. They're not going so well. So only one of them replied to me, and then they went quiet for several days. And each one of these I have independently verified as well. So I have a very high degree of confidence that these are legitimate incidents. So this is enormously frustrating. Now, at the same time, I have had three different incidents of people sending me very large volumes of data in terms of quite a number of different breaches. So think in the lines of double digits numbered breaches on each one of these. One of them is a massive stash with some stuff I recognize, a bunch of stuff I have not seen before as well. And that the problem that I'm having here is that this is just so laborious trying to disclose responsibly. And that there's not an option of disclosing irresponsibly. Like, I'm not just going to start loading data and YOLO it. That might work out very badly for me. So that's not going to happen. But I've got to get better at the disclosure piece. Now, I'm not quite sure what that will look like. I don't think it's an easy thing to, for example, get help from someone else who can help do the disclosure. Because when I approach someone and I say, look, it's me, here's who I am, read about me online, etc., there's a gravitas to that which helps me get traction and credibility, which would be a lot harder for other people. So I think that's very important. Maybe I just need to, like automate the whole process more. I don't know. If you have good ideas about this, please let me know, because I actually feel bad about sitting on so much data with possibly your information there, with the millions of Have I Been Pwned subscribers information in there, and not being able to turn it over faster. In fact, I did an interview with a journalist today, and I was saying this. I said, look, I feel my greatest responsibility is to the people that are relying on Have I Been Pwned to tell them when they're exposed. But because of the way the organizations who've lost their data are behaving, it's making me very hard to do that. But I've got to do this, otherwise I may not be able to run the service if I don't handle it responsibly. So any ideas, please let me know. All right, let's move on to something a little bit more easily explainable, quantifiable. Serverless to the max, doing big things with small dollars with Cloudflare Workers and Azure Functions. And incidentally, for the Americans who go, what's Azure? That's like Azure, but it's said correctly. So anyway, I wanted to talk about the actual cost of running this service, because many people do ask me this. Like, they're really, really curious. What does it cost to run Have I Been Pwned? Now, I have picked just one small slice of that, which is the Pwned passwords. I have written before about what it's like to run the entire service. And incidentally, it's always in the hundreds of dollars per month. I don't think it's ever been a four-figure number. Unless I had like massive amounts of data breaches to load and I had to run big SQL infrastructure for a while. Maybe that happened once with like Dropbox and MySpace and everything. I'm not sure. Be that as it may, it's still a very cost-effective system to run, but particularly Pwned passwords was enormously efficient. Still is enormously efficient. And I want to talk a little bit about how I did that. So that the purpose of this blog post was to try and give transparency to that. I'm also going to take a bunch of what I wrote about here and talk about it in .NET Conf next week. I'm going to mention that at the end of my video today. So basically, what I've done here is I've showed a Cloudflare graph. and I've got 32.4 million requests to the Pwn Passwords API over the period of a week. So roughly speaking, it's probably just under 5 million queries a day on average. Now, the interesting thing is that we've got 32.4 million requests which have gone through Cloudflare. 32.3 million of them have been cached. Now, this is a cache hit ratio of 99.62%, and I am stoked about that. I've even seen as high as 99.8% over 24-hour periods. And what that means is that the vast, vast majority of requests that go to this service are returned by Cloudflare. So you hit a local edge node, because Cloudflare's got 152 edge nodes around the world. And incidentally, I embedded a quote from Matthew Prince here, the CEO of Cloudflare, and he says, our plan is to have data centers in 250 cities and get within less than 10 milliseconds of 99% of the global population. Now, that's cool. Like, imagine if 99% of the people coming to your website could get a portion of the content back in 10 milliseconds or less. Now, when I say a portion, maybe they need to go to the origin website because they're submitting a form or something like that, but they pull back the JavaScript and the CSS and all the images and all that sort of stuff and any static pages from a location within 10 milliseconds of them. Super awesome in terms of the experience for the end user. Super awesome for you guys actually running services, because you can start reducing massively the amount of traffic that goes to your origin site. Incidentally, on this as well, I know I just spoke about the authenticity and the transparency thing. Cloudflare, Microsoft, no one had any idea I was writing this. I just wanted to sit down and write it because I thought it was cool. So we've got the 152 edge nodes. We've got 99.62% of traffic coming from them and not going to my origin. So right off the bat, that was about one in 262 requests or something, I think, have to go all the way through. What this means is that if you're paying per execution, and for the most part I'm going to get to the numbers in a moment. If you're paying per execution and you manage to reduce your execution rate 260 plus fold over, you're going to save a lot of money. So Cloudflare has helped enormously in keeping that cost down. Now, a few other stats here. I like this. The reason I realized my cache hit ratio had gone so high is because Stefan from Eve Online, now remember I've spoken before, Eve Online implemented Pwn Passwords. He DM'd Jannard Ali. So Jannard is the guy who works for Cloudflare, who's helped create all the awesome stuff that is in Pwn Passwords, the K-anonymity, the massive cache hit rate. He DMs us, and I've reproduced this with Stefan's permission. He says, what shenanigans have you guys been pulling now? 100% Cloudflare cache hit ratio in the last 24 hours. More than that, actually. Noticed it like that yesterday. More than 100%, Stefan? Or more than 24 hours? Wow. More than that, actually. Noticed it like that yesterday as well, though my metrics are off. And he's got an image here, which shows basically like there's a donut chart. And everything is blue, and there's this tiny, tiny white line which represents like some tiny fraction of 1%. So the cool thing about this is that Eve Online was getting the benefit of having a really high percentage of responses returned from a very close local data center, probably within 10 milliseconds of them, and I didn't have to do anything. Like, my cache hit ratio has just gone up. Jannard has tweaked a few things. I also never noticed when it went down, and conversely, I would never notice if the cache hit ratio fluctuated such that more traffic went to my origin because of the way Azure Functions work, and we're going to get onto that in a moment. So he sort of saw that and went, hey, this is super cool. I didn't even know it until then. Looking back through my info here as well, on the Cloudflare thing, and in fact, this is not intentional, but we keep coming back to the authenticity and transparency thing. Cloudflare does sponsor Pwn Passwords and Have I Been Pwned. So they provide some of their services for me to use. And now look, some of their services I'm dog fooding, and then I provide feedback about, look, I think this would be better this way or that way, or here's the way I've used it. So it's a nice sort of symbiotic relationship. And what I wanted to do though was just be very, very clear about what do you get when you don't pay any money, because you can get onto Cloudflare for free. So I embedded a tweet here, and in fact, this one was from the 1st of August, and it talked about the Wino HTTPS website. Oh, I've got to mention that too. Remind me to do that after I do this bit. So the Wino HTTPS website, we're achieving a K-sheet ratio on the free plan of 99.5%. Now, I deliberately wanted to keep that on the free plan because I want to be able to use exactly what everyone else can go out and get for $0 and demonstrate what we can do with it. So that 99.5%, actually, let me, I partly misspoke. It's 99.0% K-sheet ratio, 99.5% bandwidth reduction, because the bandwidth is never going to the origin now. It's just coming from Cloudflare. Incidentally, you pay for bandwidth from Azure. I'm going to come back to that. So you can still get 99 point something percent on a free plan. And that was important to me because I wanted to make sure I flagged that. Now, in both these cases, the reason the K-sheet ratios are so high is there's a large amount of cacheable content, namely content that is static. So in the case of Pwn passwords, all those hash ranges you search for are static. So there are all these 5-character prefixes. There's just over 1 million of them, 16 to the power of 5 of them. They don't change. They can be cached. For Wino HTTPS, it's basically the front page, one page for each country and a flag for each country. And there's some images and obviously some CSS and so on. And that's it. And you can cache that. So the point is that these very, very high cache ratios, due to the nature of the site, you can get that on free plan, you can get that on commercial plan. Now, moving on. Workers. So we've been using Cloudflare Workers. And Cloudflare Workers, and this speaks to the title of having serverless stuff everywhere, Cloudflare Workers are JavaScript that execute on the edge. So they run in the 152 data centers, soon to be 200-something data centers that Cloudflare has around the world. They can intercept the requests and then also modify the responses such that you can do very, very efficient things by doing code on the edge. Now, in the context of Pwn Password, what we're doing with Workers is we're normalizing the casing of the hash ranges. So let's say you wanted to search for the hash range that begins with 5 A's. You don't want to have a situation where someone searches for 5 lowercase a's, someone else searches for 5 uppercase a's, and my function, which receives this at Azure, it normalizes it all there anyway. But we should be able to reply to either from the edge, because once you do a search for all a's, it doesn't matter whether they're uppercase or lowercase. Hexadecimal doesn't care. So that's one of the things we're doing. We're normalizing that. We're also replying to any options requests. So if there's an options request to see if the client can then make a cause request from that hostname, that gets replied to from Cloudflare as well. Because all that's happening is we just come back, I'll tell you exactly what's in there. We come back with an options response, which is just access control allow origin star, access control allow methods get, access control allow headers, access control allow headers, and also the max age. And all of this can be replied effectively on the fly. It doesn't have to go back to the origin because it's just static information. So the workers help dramatically reduce the load. Now, workers, you do pay $5 a month, and then you get 10 million requests for that, and then you pay 50 cents per million requests that hit the worker after that. So you can have a worker, and you got 90% of requests don't even hit it. And then what you do is you actually define a route which will send it through the worker, and then you're going to pay for those ones. Now, I did the math on that, and it still ended up only being in the tens of dollars a month if I wanted to turn workers on and pay for it. And frankly, if I wanted to save tens of dollars a month, I could have just gone, well, we'll just cache the uppercase A's and the lowercase A's, and we'll just have, you know, effectively two caches. All right, so moving on, we're getting through to the Azure bits. Now, Azure functions are serverless. Serverless uses servers. Everyone with me? Good. So serverless uses servers. You're just paying for execution cycles on the server. In fact, you're paying for two things. You're paying for the number of executions you have, and then you're paying for how many gigabit seconds are used. And what that's saying is the average amount of memory used over a period of time. In layman's terms, the harder your function works, the more you pay. And that sounds very fair, doesn't it? You know, like this is the way it should be. Now, I've got a bit of an image in here that shows the 32 million, whatever it was, requests from Cloudflare. It shows the Azure functions executions. Now, of course, the 32 million then distilled down to much less than that. What was the number we had there? 32 million then became 122,000. And it's 122,000 because, of course, all the other stuff just got surf and cash. Now, when I look at my graph, there was a really interesting thing on the Azure end, which is that very early on, my traffic was like just leveling out at 1,000 requests. What is this time period? This time period must be an hour. It's really, really low. Yeah, it would have been an hour. So we're getting about 1,000 requests an hour, and then suddenly it goes up to 9,000 requests an hour, and then suddenly it comes all the way back down to 1,000. So at some point in time, our cache hit ratio just obviously massively dropped, and a bunch more requests went through to the origin. I never noticed it. And you might be going, yeah, well, 9,000 requests an hour, that's not very much anyway. Like, why would you notice it? But when you say that, it's sort of like, okay, well, that means for the rest of the time, I've got way more infrastructure than what I actually need, which is why I didn't notice the 1,000 going to 9,000, a 9x increase. And this was part of the problem without having serverless. And I'm going to talk about this a lot in .NET Conf next week, is that when you don't have a serverless model and you're working with logical containers of servers, like the Azure App Service, you have, say, an S3 instance of the server with, you know, 2 cores and 8 gigabytes of RAM or whatever it is, 4 cores, 7 gigabytes of RAM. Just notice behind the camera. And you've got this logical container, and you're always either underutilizing it or starting to butt up against the top of it, and then you need another one of these big containers, and then you start to use that. So it's very, very inefficient when you're not using serverless. So moving on, I wanted to go through and I quantified the function execution units, which is how hard they're working, and of course the number of requests. And then I put all this in a chart. Now, the easiest way to explain this, and I'm looking at the Excel document here. The easiest way to explain this is that I don't pay anything for Azure Functions. And the reason I don't pay anything for Azure Functions is that you get free grants. And everyone gets free grants, doesn't matter who you are. You get a free grant that allows you 400,000 gigabit seconds, and that probably sounds like a number that's very hard to actually put in context, so I will put it in context in a moment, and you get 1 million function executions. So here's the context. I had just under 115,000 executions of the function in this 1 week period, which is about 508,000 per month. So I'm doing 508,000 function executions per month. That's a lot less than the free grant, which is 1 million. So I'm not going to pay on the execution vector. The execution units, those 508,000 execution units, used a total of just over 7,000 gigabit seconds. You get 400,000 gigabit seconds. So I am scraping by at probably at under 2% of the free grant in order to execute those 114,000 requests, which are that tiny, tiny slice of the 32 million requests because of Cloudflare caching. So bottom line is, I am so far underpaying anything at all for Azure Functions, it's not even funny. If I took Cloudflare away and it suddenly started hammering Azure Functions 260 times more frequently than what it is now, it would still only cost me a very small amount of money. In fact, the amount of money it would cost is $53 a month, $53, $54 a month. And that, as far as I'm concerned, for 32 million hits a week against a querying of 517 million records, that's still a small amount of money. So that was that. Now, paying nothing for Cloudflare, Azure Functions. Blob storage, I've got 19.27 gigabytes in there, that cost me 40 cents. So I've got to pay 40 cents a month for blob storage. Blob reads, you need to pay for reads. I'm doing 508,000 reads a month because every time the Azure function is hit, it does a blob read. I'm paying 22 cents a month for that. So far, so good. Moving on down, the last bit that has any cost whatsoever is bandwidth. And bandwidth, you've got to pay, well, first of all, you get a free grant of 5 gigabytes a month. Then after that, what do you pay? You pay 8.7 cents. Incidentally, all these dollar amounts are US dollars because that's just the most globally understood, rightly or wrongly. You pay 8.7 cents per gigabyte. So I'm paying 16 cents a month in bandwidth. All said and done, total cost per month is 77.9 cents. per day is 2.6 cents. It's costing me 2.6 cents a day to let you guys do 32 million queries a week against 517 million records. That's awesome. That is just totally, totally awesome. And all the feedback from everyone has been, that is totally, totally awesome. And it's not because I'm some freaking genius on this. I've just used the things that are out there that everyone has access to, either for free or for very tiny amounts of money. So I mentioned I sort of did the math on this. I took Cloudflare out of it altogether. When I took Cloudflare out of it altogether, it came down to $9.19 a day, which frankly is still bloody good for that amount of queries. But why would you take Cloudflare out of it altogether? If you'd wanted to have Cloudflare and not pay for it, you'd get it. You'd use the free one. You wouldn't use the workers, so your K-ship ratio would drop a bit. Maybe you'd only get like 90% K-ship ratio, for argument's sake. It's still going to shave 90% or thereabouts of the cost off, which is going to bring you down to about $1 a day. So whichever way you cut it, it's just massively efficient to run with a combination of Cloudflare doing the caching and Azure Functions on the back end. It's just, I'm so happy. You know, like the geek inside me is just so stoked about how cool this is. And I've got more and more stuff in Have I Been Pwned that's working over there. Moving over there. And over time, what that's doing is it's making Have I Been Pwned way more resilient because these functions just scale infinitely. Well, I haven't found a threshold yet, put it that way. And it's bringing the cost way, way down because I'm starting to reduce the number of simultaneous servers I need to run. And after I finish moving a few other things over, I'm actually going to be able to scale from S3 probably back down to S2 and halve the cost of the web server that's actually running there. So super stoked about that. And again, I'm going to speak a lot more about it, and you'll be able to ask me questions at .NET Conf next week. All right, let's move on because I am conscious of time. So a couple of last remaining bits of business here. So sponsor this week is Gold Security. Gold Security has been a sponsor for a very long time now. So I really appreciate their support in doing what they do. So go and check them out. Tell them I said hi because it's nice if sponsors know that they actually get noticed. And I have had some lovely feedback. I won't say which sponsor it is, but some really nice feedback this week about how good it has been for them. So hopefully you might see some familiar sponsors in 2019. Last two things. Next week, Scott Helm's coming. So we have got the NDC conference in Sydney the week after next. He is coming down here. I think he gets here on Wednesday. So he's going to have some Gold Coast time to chill out, get chased by Aussie animals, all that sort of stuff. We're going to go war jet skiing. I think I've mentioned this before. So I will not be throwing him off while he has his laptop. Anyway, he's going to bring the pineapples and the laptops and everything. I'm just kind of, I don't know if it's been done before. So if you're interested in what you can get from war jet skiing or you have suggestions, please let me know. So I might do the update next week from the Gold Coast with him, and then I'll be in Sydney with him the week after that as well. So I'll do a couple of updates with Scott. And lastly, I mentioned .NET Conf several times. So this is a virtual conference. I'll be doing it from my home just here. It runs Friday morning my time. If you're in Australia, I think that's going to make it about 10 a.m. on Friday next week. I will actually link to it so you know where to register. So come along there. I'm going to share a heap of stuff, some of which you've heard today, a bunch of other stuff I've never spoken about before. There's going to be pictures and graphs and things like that, and lots of opportunity to ask questions too. And once again, I do love getting questions from people because it does make all of these events, particularly whether they're the sort of face-to-face conferences like the Sydney and Melbourne ones or the Veronis one the other day, getting questions and engagement and interaction just makes it a whole lot more interesting for me. It also helps me understand what are the important things on people's mind, which then leads to some of the other things that I create and do. So thank you very much for watching this week, and I will come to you next week with Scott from the Gold Coast.